Welcome to Sapientia. I'm James.
And I'm Justin.
And today's topic, we've got a special one for you. If you tuned into our Fill the Gaps episode, you'll know that it is about economies. What are they? What do they do? Why do they exist? What good are they? And how do we approach them? How do we criticize them? And can we make them better? So please answer all of those questions in that order.
Well, I'll certainly try. I guess we ought to just start with what an economy is. An economy is just an area of productivity and distribution of resources. It's very, very vague by necessity, but basically anytime you have groups of people organizing together to make things and distribute them, you have an economy.
Seems pretty simple.
Mm-hmm. So the more interesting question is, why do we have economies? What purpose do they serve?
Well, I like being employed, so that's a plus. But, I mean, obviously the objective of an individual company, corporation, small business, what have you, at whatever level in this economy is either to provide a good or service that isn't already being provided that needs to be, providing one that can be better than what's already there in some way, or just making money, you know, turning a profit, you know, collecting capital, hoarding it in Swiss bank accounts. Hot take, we'll get to that.
So perhaps a more interesting question too would be, why should I participate in an economy? Why should an individual participate?
Well, the market will quickly throw you out if you don't. So there is that.
I think If we look back into the history of human relations, at some point we just realized banding together into communities was better than sticking it out alone. We're highly social species, and so economies naturally come from that inclination to form communities. Ergo, I would argue that the purpose of an economy is really just to provide for the betterment of the people who are participating in that economy. If you could even go back to as far as Adam Smith, one of the first economic thinkers, we'll see that he would argue economies allow for greater and greater subdivision of labor, and with that, more and more prosperity, more and more specialization, which will inevitably liberate people, allow them to do what they do, and have more things, just be able to enjoy the luxuries of life more fully.
Absolutely. And it's all well and good to think, oh, you know, if we could get rid of money or get rid of corporations or get rid of X, Y, and Z, like, that's all fine. But a lot of the things that we depend on, not only for necessity, but for luxury, like you said, revolve around the ability to accumulate some amount of wealth. And there is not, you think back to, you know, ancient Greece and Rome, where even in their, you know, Greece before it really became kind of a unified, overarching, like, before it was Greece, it was the Hellenic states. You know, before it was the Roman Empire, it was just Rome. And the trading was mercantile. You know, I give you a good, you give me a good, and there's not money qua yet. You're exchanging capital for capital. Of course, once the Hellenic states become, you know, the Greek Empire, once, you know, the Roman Republic grows and becomes the Roman Empire, money is now a much more easily tradable and easily recognizable value system. Once you get to a certain size, you have to standardize. So we use money, because if you say here, you know, the, whether it's the market or the government that says, here is this note, I'm going to give it to you, it has this amount of value, and what that value means is going to change based on how I tell you it's going to change, which sounds really bad in its broad strokes, but roughly speaking, it gets simpler because we got bigger.
Yeah, and it's actually interesting that you mentioned ancient Greece too, because if we go back to what economics is linguistically, it descends from this Greek word oikos, which meant house. So the economics was really just the concern of maintaining personal wealth. You know, it was only until we actually started building sprawling empires, and then eventually you started trading between countries and whatnot, that we actually took economics to mean something much bigger than that.
Absolutely. I always love a good ancient Greek plug.
Yeah.
I mean, so, small sidebar. We decided on a name for the coffee maker. It was the one that I gave last time, Coffee Entia. I gave it in passing as a kind of a joke. It turns out that that was the best we got. Anybody that knows Aristotle might appreciate that I tried to come up with Megalobrukia, a play on Aristotle's Greek word megalosukia, meaning magnanimity, from his Ethics. But
Coffee Entia is Megalobrukia.
Yes, I completely agree. Gloria ad Coffee Entia, as they might say in the, you know,
Hellenic states.
Well, it's Latin, so probably not.
Fair enough.
Well, they might have at one point.
So what, now that we've kind of like cleaved this part off, the bulk of this episode will be going over the big three economic theories: capitalism, socialism, and communism. As you, James, you've already started talking about capitalism, so is there anything more you want to add to spice up capitalism?
So capitalism, as we know, gets a really bad rap lately, and I understand why. It has a pretty horrific track record of worker disenfranchisement, subjugation of labor to extreme situations by violent and nonviolent means, depending on how you define violence. But we forget sometimes through all of that thick that it's done a lot of really great things. Like, the poorest poor people that exist, at least in the United States now, are arguably far better off now than they were 100 years ago. That's debatable how you want to lay that claim out in terms of what better is. But overall, everybody is increasing in general well-being and prosperity. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that it's all because of the capitalist system that we adopted as part of the Industrial Revolution and even before that, but it definitely helped.
Right. And actually, I think that statistic applies globally, that the poorest poor person in the world is much wealthier, like, I think by orders of magnitude now, than they were just 20 years ago.
Oh yeah, it's kind of insane. So before you just knock capitalism for everything it's worth, no pun intended, remember that it has done good things. Arguably not always and not well or efficiently, but it has done good things.
Right. So capitalism, to paint and to define it as best one can, is a form of market economy. It's, you take private property, which is basically broadly things owned by individual people that invest it into a market, and the whole point of this system is to accrue wealth. So you take wealth that you already have, and then you try to expand it and make it more wealth. Part of the way you do this is because it's recognizing that transactions aren't zero sum. So suppose you really need a TV and I really need a couch, and you have a TV and I have a couch. Wait, did I do that right?
I want the TV. And
I have the TV. You have the couch.
Yeah, you want my couch.
So at this point, I don't really care for the couch. James doesn't really care for the TV. So if I give him my couch and he gives me his TV, there's actually a gain in value here, because I value his TV more than he does, and he values my couch more than I do. So by exchanging these goods, we build value. And this is the grounding of capitalism. So the reason why you control property privately is because you recognize that this depends on how I value things and how James values things. So by keeping things in private interests, we can decentralize this system and allow it to happen freely. And theoretically, if we all control some measure of property, it will inevitably yield high-valued exchanges.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Justin's probably going to have a sore back when he passes out watching TV on the floor, but I'll be nice and comfy reading my book.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Of course.
It's more likely to be a hunch over a computer, but You know, I just don't value my back that much. So maybe a maybe I'll just have to pay more for a chiropractor.
Well, if you don't value your back that much, the capitalist will lay its greasy steel hand upon it.
You mean an invisible one, right?
It's not invisible. It's real.
The first thinker of capitalism was Adam Smith, and he tried to lay out a way in which capitalism works. As I had said, he thought that as markets develop, you get greater and greater subdivision of labor, greater and greater specialization with greater and greater productivity. I don't know if I want to transition to communism yet. Are we done?
No, I think that's a good transition point.
He theorized that the way capitalism works is by a labor theory of value. So labor theory of value is essentially that things have value because I put labor into it. If there's no labor that goes in anything, it just doesn't have value. So if there's just a tree in the wild that has apples on it, those apples don't have value. But if I go out, pick the apple, put it in a basket, and bring it to you, it now has value because I injected labor into this. And Adam Smith thought that ultimately all of our economic activity was in trying to maximize the labor value we had at our command. Because, well, if you're a population of mostly farmers, or you would be farmers otherwise, being able to command labor allowed you to not have to do the normal tasks you would with farming, not have to till the land, you wouldn't have to farm your own crops, you wouldn't have to slaughter your own animals, and that liberated you to do other things. So how does this transition to communism was, well, communism is the belief that if you recognize that this is how an economy works, and you have capitalists who are investing money through private property, and you have workers who are, you know, trying to get capital by performing some labor for the capitalist literally cannot pay you the value of your work. It's impossible, because if they did, they wouldn't be making money. So in order to maintain a profit margin, they have to be paying you less than your labor's worth, by Adam Smith's own logic.
Absolutely. I we can get into counters later, but I would say the institution that allows for such a product to actually be produced, for such labor to actually be undertaken, is a piece of the capital owned by the capitalist that, sure, cannot completely, give you recompense for all of the labor that you've put into a product, but can give you a place where that production can occur, presumably safely.
Yeah, and as we had alluded earlier, modern capitalism doesn't subscribe to the labor theory of value. It's a heterodox school. It's a heterodox theory now. The common theory is a subjective theory of value, where, you know, I value things differently than James does, and that's why we have transactions, which is usually the way communism is attacked. Now, that doesn't say that there isn't economists who actually hold the labor theory of value, but they're just far less common now. Most economists don't care to get into this sort of normative claims that the labor theory of value seems to inject.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think about that, because there is a lot of, you know, well, I do, you know, X, Y, and Z work, and then you think about, oh, I make this little money, and then a whole bunch of it gets taken out in taxes, and, like, I get that. But it's easy in that situation to lose the perspective, though I wouldn't go too far with that. It's easy to lose some perspective, but if you're really getting shafted, like, that's an issue. But and then we have communism. You know, you remember those farmers you were talking about? Lenin killed them all.
Yeah. Yeah, communism doesn't have a great track record either. I mean, capitalism has done some bad things too, and I think it's, well, we'll get into more specifics later, but one thing I hope that the listeners get out of this is real economies are more complicated than this.
Oh, absolutely. Like, And we'll have a whole section on globalization in a little bit, and why economies got astronomically more complicated and honestly politically more powerful than most countries at this point.
Yeah. But I think you're exactly right to point out, too, that the worker in this hypothetical situation only has the capacity to really make a whole lot because of the capital itself confers some value. And right. This is, again, the subjective theory of value coming into play. Well, also even more than that, just like a worker is not going to be as productive unless he has like a factory, for instance. If 100 workers working on a factory is going to be more productive than a single worker trying to do all that thing, subdivision of labor. But there's another, let's transition to socialism then.
All right, so we're going to marry them. Capitalism and communism got married. They had a bastard child before they got married, and it's socialism.
Well, so socialism kind of came out of the communist school of thought. There was these utopian socialists, which imagine that you can kind of extrapolate this to whole class. But essentially, communism is this belief that, we can organize work around labor itself, right? Socialists take the view that you can democratize the systems such that we can provide for individuals and for workers, right? But we don't have to wholesale get rid of the whole market apparatus, right? There's different flavors of socialism and communism, and I think socialism is the hardest one to grapple with, but it's in this vein where you're intimately concerned with workers and intimately concerned with the well-being of individuals and how you can socialize that such that it's not a small class of individuals or private property controlling things.
Right. For those who have read, who have actually read any Marx or Engels or even Hegel for that matter, that fundamental idea of, getting the power of production and consumption of labor into smaller and smaller hands, well, trickling it down into the broader population is very much a firm point in communism, though ironically that's like the first thing that went out the window in the Soviet Union when communism really took hold. Like, that was the first thing that went. Like, you basically... you got your government assigned job, you went to it, and you maybe got enough money to pay for your basic expenses, and like the whole thing was really machined. Like, you didn't own anything. In fact, you know, the whole identity came from, look at this glorious state that you're a part of. And that's even, you can see that still in North Korea. It's starting to change. As North Korea is starting to get socialized into, I guess, the real world, or just the rest of the world, I think Kim Jong-un is starting to realize, like, hey, wait, there's other stuff out here that I want, and this system is not going to give it to me.
Well, I can't comment too much on the North Korea situation, but I think you're pointing out something really important to bear in mind. So a lot of the difference between these three things is really... who owns capital and who owns the means of production, right? In capitalism, it's all privately owned, right? In communism, it's the means of production are owned by a state entity, usually. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
And because there's form of communism that are anarchic. I feel like I need to say this now. Communism, in an idyllic communism, you wouldn't need a state body. It would be fully anarchic. Obviously, this is really hard to do at scale, and so typically you end up needing a state.
Right. And, you know, to point out one of the many criticism levied against communism is that it creates that power vacuum, like, in communism qua. Like, that's the fundamental form of communism, and it creates this power vacuum. And every time we've seen it occur, somebody's filled it.
Yeah, Right. It's just because, like, communism works. Like, and just give you an example. Communism, your family's probably a communist, like a small communist pocket. Like, and this is really weird to think about. Like, but you don't, everyone in your family just does what they need to do to make sure the household stays afloat. You distribute resources based on what people's needs, and you don't really need a state apparatus, even though there's some more or less chain of authority, like, implicit there. Again, how would you make that scale? That's the hard part.
Well, and a lot of it, the hard part in scaling that is, like, you're doing something in your house and it's destructive to some other family member. Well, they're going to discipline you somehow, mm-hmm. because there is an understood contract between all of you that when one of you acts against the better will of all of them, they say, no, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. And it's all self-contained. I think that's where the scale problem is.
Right, exactly.
Just where does the authority to stop somebody from doing something come from? You know, do you end up in a domino effect where, you know, you kill my friend, so I kill you, and then one of your friends kills me, and then one of my friends kills that friend, and it's like, and then boom, everybody's dead, to be really Kantian about it.
Then we have to tame the Furies.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
That's a Greek reference.
It is.
Yeah.
But we have Ambien now.
Oh, fair. So then socialism is democratizing the means of production, so such that it's publicly controlled. This wouldn't mean, like... Again, there's many, many different flavors of socialism. Some of them would argue, you know, like, you need corporations to have democratic controls inside of them, like something like the Mondragon Corporation. Some of them would be that your state would actually control companies at large. There's also market socialism, where you have, you know, markets, and there are controls in the market that are social, that are public. Because once we cross into this bridge where, like, somewhere between, you know, like a full state communism and capitalism, there's so many gradations. So this is why I feel hard pressed to put, like, a specific thing on socialism, but there's one thing that they all share in common. The means of production are socialized.
Absolutely. And one thing that I would talk about as a division of private versus public, and that's when people talk about the market, they're usually talking about the stock market. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that you say public, mm-hmm. because that's when a company goes public. That's whenever they decide to start selling off pieces of their company to the general populace for a certain amount of value that some statistician on Wall Street or wherever is deciding that happens. So do we want to transition into how we deal with the stonks?
Yeah. So I think there's only one other thing I want to say about capitalism, too, just to make these things really salient. Capitalism is private means of production. And as James indicated, like, you know, people are buying these. People own pieces of a company and that sort of thing. A lot of the other two theories, socialism and communism, is just trying to get away from the problem of capitalism, where a small group of individuals essentially controls nearly everything. Which right. is a problem within capitalism, and most capitalists would recognize it as a problem because it hurts competition. So now we can get into, you know, more specifics about this.
Right. So specifically about capitalism, and arguably even the stock market ends up ushering in a whole host of problems when it comes to individuals mm-hmm. controlling things, because you end up with a few people who own a majority of the shares of a corporation, and then they basically control it. Like, they become the, you know, people on the the shareholders commissioner board or board of directors of a company are just, oh, well, I own, you know, 20,000 shares in company X, and, you know, these five other people own about the same amount, and then the next highest person owns like 20 shares. Mm-hmm. So you end up with the same kind of vacuum. But I want to, pardon me for reading specifically off of this, but I want to go into this in a little bit of detail, and thank you NBC News and NerdWallet for providing me with this information, because I know next to nothing about stock markets before this. So, you know, when a company gets to a certain size, they can choose to go public and sell stocks or shares on an exchange like New York Stock Exchange, Wall Street, or NASDAQ, or something like that. People are allowed to buy pieces of that company. And when they do that, they become partial owners of that company, essentially not socializing it, but democratizing it to some degree. Larger companies who have, you know, millions of shareholders, obviously that's not the case. The, like I said, the few, like 10 or fewer that have the most shares are the ones kind of in control of that. So, like I said, and a lot of times the goal of these shareholders, the board of directors, is just to make those 10 people more money. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that translates into your average shareholder in that company also making more money. But for companies that give workers packages in their wages that include shares in that company, like, oh, look, you can work for us and we're going to give you some shares in the company so you kind of like own it and stuff. And apparently they're Kermit the Frog. False. They're going to get screwed because in order to make the top shareholders more money, the labor is going to get devalued. That's just the way it goes. Mm-hmm. And chances are it's going to get outsourced to China.
Yeah.
We need to stand up to China. No offense, China, but you earned it. So essentially, once the stocks go on these markets, they're bought and sold at different values depending on how well the company is doing. So generally, if a company is doing very well, the demand for their shares goes up, which means that every share is worth more subsequently. That translates into companies that aren't doing well, their share value goes down. Obviously, if it goes down too much, the company's bankrupt. Kmart, Sears, Toys R Us, you know, have your pick. So that's part of it. So there's a couple of different kinds of shares in terms of investment. So there are things that are high risk, high reward that are generally shorter term investments that generate, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of dollars. You're looking for the companies that are increasing in value really quickly. You buy up some shares when they're cheap. They go up in value. They start to decline a little. You sell them off. You make some money. And, you know, you get the sort of spiky sine wave of, you know, the average company doing its average thing. You make a little bit of money. And that's that. Now, if you are tuned into the news, you'll know that back on the 14th of August, the Dow Jones, which is an exchange index, fell by 800 points in one day, which is an absolute record of a drop in the value of the stock. So an index is basically an aggregation of a bunch of different companies under one title. So it's abbreviated DJIA, or Dow Jones Industrial Average. So it's taking a whole bunch of different industrial corporations, averaging their values statistically with some other funky, magical, statistical nonsense that nobody really understands, and generates a number that people do understand. When that goes down, it means that the average value of all of those companies has gone down. And to put that in perspective, like, Dow Jones is usually hovering at like 26,000, or it was, in value, arbitrary unit of value, and it fell 800 points in that, which doesn't seem like a lot, but that's a whole lot of average has to go in to drop it that much. So this usually has in the past pointed to a recession. So what we're seeing is that this market, which is allowing small groups of individuals to make money, but it's also allowing larger groups of individuals to have a little piece of that. They can get a little bit of that money. And that's kind of where trickle-down economics comes from in capitalism. It doesn't trickle down. Even for people that invest well, it very rarely yields anything usable until you retire.
Mm-hmm.
But this creates a really interesting power vacuum in a way, because people who can buy up all of these shares have a ton of economic power and can crash companies.
I would even argue political power.
Oh, absolutely. You know, lobbyists get their money from somewhere. You should ask them sometime. They'll lie to you.
Yeah. And while we're on that, we can talk about rent seeking too, because you're right. It does. What this essentially does is it's a big problem. It gets a small group of people with a lot of power, economic power. But we oftentimes think of economies being separate from their political institutions that they that give them their grounding. But they're not. And so one of the bad things of capitalism is that it can sometimes generate really perverse incentives. And since you're only concerned about generating wealth, you're going to seek out whatever the easiest method is. Some of those methods are not good for productivity and are not good for people's well-being. These are called rent-seeking methods. This is a good example when we're talking about lobbyists. Suppose that I can generate more profits by, you know, investing in new R&D to generate some novel technology, and for every dollar I invest, I get like $1.10, right? 10% return on investment, that's pretty good. Or I can give $100,000 to some number of politicians, and those politicians produce regulation that gives me a comparative advantage. And so for every dollar I put into that, I make $1.20.
Yeah. And so to go along with that, you should take a look at who the executives are in, like, the Department of Agriculture, the FDA, names like ConAgra, Monsanto, what's one of the big pharma companies?
Tyson.
Yeah. All right, Tyson for another food production. Wow. The big pharma one is escaping me for some reason.
Yeah, well, research for you. Look them up. It's kind of scary. There's
yeah.
too many to remember at this point. Basically, a lot of the government agencies are filled with business interests. And that produces rent-seeking behavior, which is what we see a lot of in today's economy.
Absolutely. And I would argue, in some cases, having business interests in government is really positive,
mm-hmm.
because it can allow for companies to grow and produce capital that makes the average person's life in that government constituency better. Again, not really where that goes usually,
yeah.
but... offshore bank accounts, it's a thing, look it up. If instead all of that money, instead of getting funneled into some, you know, Swiss bank account, got generated as capital for, you know, the average individual, even if it's private institutions that people have to pay for, like, you're creating something that has positive impact, mm-hmm. and can be accessed by far more people than just you.
Yeah. And as part of this is you can look at roads, actually, but part of the big impetus of roads is to create transportation to spur business, and well, it largely worked. I mean, having trucks and automobiles being able to travel from place to place on fast interstates allowed for a lot more commerce between states.
Absolutely. Now, you've self-described as a libertarian in the past. Do roads scare you?
Yeah, I think they should be privatized. And while we're at it, we should just privatize healthcare. And why do we have a state?
Yeah, I don't know. I think the state is just there to keep us down. I mean, honestly, like, U.S. government, it's just the Russians, really. It's just Russians, point two. Like,
right.
Go to Capitol Hill and just be like, конечно, хорошо. And just, like, see how many people perk their ears up and just, ah, da.
while we're at it, though, this is kind of like the end of capitalism, right? So if you believe that private institutions are more efficient than public institutions, then it does seem reasonable to say, why not privatize as much as possible? And the only purpose of a state is to just, you know, shore up the weaknesses. And as I said earlier, this gets at my point where it's like, economies are not separable from the social and political institutions that give them their grounding.
Absolutely, especially in places where single companies make more money than governments collect in taxes, which means that governments as institutions potentially in the economy are less powerful in controlling these companies than the companies are of controlling the governments.
Yeah. Wow. While we're on that,
if you want some extra doses of hot takes, feel free to join us on Patreon. We're thinking about how we're going to get those tiers set up, and we're thinking that some potentially weekly or bi-weekly hot takes, you know, 5-10 minutes of somebody says something absurd and we just rail off on it and try to generate some memes. So get around it, you know, check out the tiers. It's still a work in progress, but we thank anybody and everyone that contributes anything that they have. You know, as it says in the description, trying to film somewhere other than my bedroom.
Capitalism also has the main driver of capitalism is understanding that there's a bunch of different countervailing factors, right? If everyone has private property that gives everyone like a stake in the market, right? And if given these powers, everyone has different wants, different desires, and different needs, and these things compete. Different companies compete to fulfill these desires as cheaply as possible. People will buy the cheapest thing. Even laborers will try to shop around for the best form of employment that gives them the best return on their investment. You know, like they put in a certain amount, if you're willing to pay you more, give you better benefits and whatnot. And the recognition is that through the diversification, through the decentralization of market powers, these countervailing forces will inevitably lead to greater and greater efficiency. It's the invisible hand that Adam Smith would talk about. Problem is that they are countervailing forces that want to consume each other, right? If you're a business, you want to defeat your competition because they are fundamentally reducing the amount of profits you can make. And the government has an interest in trying to, or people rather, individuals and everyone else in the economy has an interest in trying to maintain that level of competition. And so you kind of do need some ways of controlling this, or otherwise capitalism can destroy itself.
It's so bizarre. Like, it's so funny how easily that follows itself.
Right.
Like, it's mind-boggling.
So with that in mind, I had said that there's a lot of different flavors of socialism, and it's really hard to recognize, but there's also a lot of different flavors of capitalism. Mark Blyth is an economist in the capitalist school of economics, and he can identify at least three distinct capitalist economies in the last century in the U.S. As an example, from what I can recall from memory, from 1945 to 1973, we had productivity match wage growth, right? But they were still in a capitalist economy. And the reason why that happened is because you had a different regime where you had good business regulations. You had big labor advocating for laborers in the market. You had a lot of businesses competing with each other. And these forces, when well-balanced, produced really good effects for average persons. Thing is, after a while, inflation got to be really high, and as a capitalist, you know, you could just wait for inflation instead of investing, and it would be a greater return on investment, and so the whole thing came toppling down, because essentially other forces got too much power. Now we're in the opposite. Capitalists have way too much power, and now wage growth is basically flatlined while productivity continues to soar.
Right, and some of that too, to put some economy terms on that, specifically misusing language, to say from the 40s until the 70s, basically up until Reaganomics took over, the value was in labor. So a capitalist who invests in labor will produce wage growth along with productivity. That's just kind of a natural consequence of investing in labor. So the big change that happened was that, you know, Reagan comes along, and that's pretty much the whole driving force behind all of this change, was Reagan comes along, the economy does some really terrible stuff, it's starting to collapse, and Reagan's like, yo, let's fix this. So rather than having a labor-focused economy where capitalists have, you know, between, say, 10 and 20% of their actual value as a corporation is capital, you've moved in the complete opposite direction where 10 to 20% of a company's value is now labor, and the rest of that value, more or less, is capital, mm-hmm. or just excess stuff. You know, the things that you write off as a business expense to, you know, just do whatever you want with.
Actually, and it's funny because this actually interestingly ties in with the 08 housing crisis.
Oh, my word.
Do you,
yeah.
Do you want me to? Or?
Well, I can do a better Scottish accent. So I want to quote Blythe on this a little bit. So he's talking about how from, you know, the 80s up until like 2007, 2008, that's pretty much how things went. And the economy started to go downhill precipitously in 2007 until it led to the, you know, big crash in 2007, 2008. And so the banks, who were so caught up in the credit boom in the 80s and 90s where, you know, oh, look, we have, you know, electronic systems for keeping track of how much debt you have. Well, here's a card that we're going to give you, specifically Citibank, that we can track all of that. And, you know, we're going to lend you the money and then you pay it back with some interest fee, was a lot lower at the time because lending was really popular. And so we created this system in the 90s and into the 2000s where lending was what made you money. But banks, specifically Citibank, just started lending like crazy. And when they realized the economy was going to fail, they lent even harder to try to save it because that was what was generating them wealth. The banks fail.
Yeah.
So here it is, they have to turn over on all of this debt that they have subsumed by the individuals and other corporations that are borrowing from them. And so the banks are like, hey, U.S. government, can we have money? And foolishly, the government's like, yo, we got you. And so now, and this is where Blythe comes in, he says, so basically after that, we say, how's the economy doing? And the banks are standing there on top of their suitcases trying to cram it down. And they say, yep, we've got it under control. It's all fine. just like trying to keep this mess contained into a small package, which is why we really haven't seen any amount of real sustainable growth since 2008. Because it booms a little and busts more, and then booms a little, and then busts more, because we're not dealing with the lending crisis. So we're now going through even shorter phases where, oh, lending is really popular and makes money, so you get a low interest rate. Well, then everybody is in debt, so their credit scores go down, so credit is less valuable, which means that lending tightens, which means that your interest rates go sky high if you can even get a loan, and credit cards have more fees, higher interest rates, all that kind of stuff, and even like CDs, short-term banking investments, things like that, have lower yields every year than they would in a lending-friendly environment. So here we are where, you know, of course it's easy to get student loans because
you can't default on those.
Yeah, you can't default on them. They're gigantic, so even getting an interest rate of 7%, which if you had a car loan, you say, oh, 7%'s not the worst. It's not great, but it's not the worst. Like, 7%, like, compounding on $30,000 at a minimum, if not, you know, $100,000, is gigantic. Like,
yeah.
You just pay so much, and that's, you know, of course, it's, you know, 7% of whatever it is right then, or whatever it is of that payment, and it's like, that's huge.
Mm-hmm. This just shows you how much of economics really does interplay with politics, right? Because one reason why student loans still are okay and, like, yield value is because you literally can't declare bankruptcy on them. So it's unique in that respect. If you could, the whole system would just come collapsing down.
Oh, yeah.
Almost instantaneously.
There's what? How many hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in student loan debt in total? I don't know. Hey. Bernie Sanders rattles off that number very regularly. I just can't I can't remember what it is off the top of my head.
You know, 17% of student loans are delinquent. 21% in Texas.
Okay, so don't go to school in Texas, or if you live in Texas, don't go to school.
Well, they're getting the U.S. Marshals on them recently.
Wow! Who?
But it shows you, you know, the institutions that we have, our economic institutions, are kind of predicated on some of the political institutions that we have. I mean, I think that the only reason why we're still existing in this economy is because we made that choice in 2008 to socialize the risk.
Yeah, and so it was a bad choice. We shouldn't have done that. Letting the banks fail, letting the whole system come crashing down, would have given us an opportunity to turn it around and create a system that wouldn't have done that so much. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, for those of you who are concerned with your credit score, know how this works. You know, your debt to income ratio is what determines your credit score. Somewhat, your regular above minimum payments on various loans, credit card bills, even utilities to some degree. The regularity and size of your payments does impact your credit score positively. But it just goes to show you, to do well in this economy and to get people to trust you with money, you have to be in debt, which means that the market forces always have a hold of you in order for you to do well, mm-hmm. which means that they can destroy you at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, it's there's too much power and capital right now.
Absolutely.
And that means that most people, regular people, you know, employees, wage earners, you know, consumers even, don't have much power in this market, right? And that's, like, fundamentally the problem. You know, we had too much labor power in 1945 to 1973. Now we have too much capital power. We're just propping that up with our political institutions. Now we've kind of actually this segues interestingly into why there's a new resurgence in the interest in socialism and communism, because we saw in 2008 we were willing to socialize the risk when these capitalists failed, essentially, and when banks plummeted, we decided as a society to, you know, bring them back up. And so it leads to an interesting question: well, why can't we do this for people?
Well, I mean, if you look at Citizens United, the corporations are people. The banks are people.
Yeah.
We hate Citizens United. Please, let's destroy it.
Yeah, that was just a straight bad. And, like, yeah, and that's also, again, how politics affects economics, because a lot of, like, my friend had asked this interesting question. We allow the death penalty for people, but not corporations. Yet there are people. The thing is that we like, they have their political entities now. Right, and yet we don't. It seems that they get a lot of privileges for that, and none of the costs.
Right, yeah. For those who don't know, Citizens United basically was a regulatory bill passed in the 90s, I think.
I think the early 2000s. So I don't know.
90s, early 2000s. They basically said that corporations, before that, were limited to how much they could give for political campaigns and to lobbying. And Citizens United essentially did away with that they there were less restrictions on amount and type of spending that private corporations could do for, you know, lobbyists, presidential candidates, Senate seats, all of that stuff. So, you know, the kind of tongue-in-cheek tagline of Citizens United is corporations are people too, And, like, that's kind of how it works now.
It's bad.
Yeah, it's entirely suboptimal.
Entirely suboptimal. Yeah, so I guess the socialist plug here would be that, well, clearly we are willing to socialize some aspects of the market. So if we're going to be, if already we require regulation to keep these things in check, and if already political, economic institutions are granted political enfranchisement, then it seems entirely plausible to rein this in with political means and say, we will democratize you now, and now you have to be beholden to public interest. And by public interest, I mean like people can vote to affect markets, or perhaps even like laborers in a corporation have some say in that corporation by sheer dint of being employed by them.
Yeah, and to put it in Jordan Peterson's word, you have to adopt responsibility and go out and make a positive difference in the world. And like, of course, he says that to, you know, individual people, but it's like that can apply really well to corporations. Like, they could do amazing things.
Yeah.
They have like nearly blank checks to do anything that they want, but instead they serve the needs of very, very small people. Like, I hope the Koch brothers get reunited soon. They're a great example. Or the Waltons, mm-hmm. Great example. The Walton family, of course, is currently the descendants of the Walmart Corporation. So when it was founded, they get royalties from the company. So, you know, and admittedly, one of the granddaughters of, was it the granddaughter, great-granddaughter of the founder, like, she's like, I've never worked a day in my life, and she's worth like $6 billion. It's like, the average person doesn't understand how much $6 billion is, because we can't fathom spending that much money. You know, if your average house is $200,000, that's 5 houses per million, that's 1,000 million, that's 5,000 houses.
Yeah, it's an insane amount of money. And, I mean, I would... One must wonder why anyone should have that amount of money.
Yeah, and, you know, Bill Gates gets picked on a lot, too, because he has lots of money. He also, you know, started a tech industry that just happened to do really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
And one could argue, like, potentially he's more deserving of his wealth than somebody as a member of the Walton family that's never contributed anything to the corporation and still reaps huge paychecks from it. And I would agree. I do think he deserves some of his wealth, certainly more than somebody who just up the wealth from something that they didn't even have a part of.
Right.
He also gives a lot. I mean, he has a lot that he doesn't give, but he doesn't give a lot. He has a lot and doesn't give enough of it, but he does give a lot.
Yeah, and this gets us, so when we're talking about economics, we can get back to the purpose of an economy, right? If it's to improve the general well-being of the people participating in the economy, right, then clearly cases like this great-great-granddaughter of the Walton family is producing bad incentives, right? If, as you said, corporations have the ability to do massive amounts of good. Truly, they do. If we set up our incentives right, they would. But right now, the incentives are really bad. The system that we have currently encourages, really, rent-seeking.
Absolutely. Like, several years ago, some of you will remember this, Burger King bought Tim Hortons as a company. And this move, well, maneuver, let me say maneuver. This maneuver allowed them to move their corporate headquarters out of the U.S. They're no longer a U.S. company. They're a Canadian company. And that absolves them of paying certain amounts of taxation that would ordinarily be levied against them by being a corporation in this country, being a U.S. corporation. So, you know, we've moved from, you know, the, you know, 60s and 70s, where you saw a lot of exportation of labor moving to, you know, third world countries or just like people around the world who are generally disenfranchised, who now, you know, the market has come bursting through the door and say, you're going to work for 10 cents a day now, you know, or you'll die. And they ensure that you will die if you don't do that. And so you went from that to an even larger extreme of exportation of entire corporations. You're moving them out of their, you know, the founding countries and moving them to somewhere where the regulations are different, where the taxes are different, where they don't have to pay as much, which of course is a negative move for the, you know, the U.S. government, let's say in this case, because now that's less taxes that they collect, which means that their market power has decreased by that amount.
Mm-hmm. I suspect this is where you want to get into globalism.
Yeah. So another thing that people will recognize, and this is aside from social politics, where I'm going to specifically say that any mention of nationalism from here is not specifically to do with social structures. This is mm-hmm. purely economic structures. There's been a resurgence of the idea of nationalism lately. And that is, you know, kind of as a response to globalism. So globalism is this move from market economies in individual countries with some interaction internationally, but like international trade was not a big thing, at least for the U.S., until something like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, which essentially set up systems of trade routes and low tariffs to incentivize trading between the three countries at will. You know, we're all close, we're connected. It makes a lot of sense to do something like that. Well, what started to happen, this went farther than just, oh, we're on the same continent, so we're going to trade with each other. This went to, we're on the same planet, we're going to trade with each other. And what this creates is another global political entity, if you will. The market, the big universal market now, the global market, is itself a large political force that dominates every part of, you know, individuals' lives and even individual countries' lives. Countries that are developing, let's say in like Africa, parts of like lower Asia and places like that, they're developing, they're getting their economies to a place where they want to enter the global market. If they don't enter the global market in just the right way, with just the right productivity, with just the right tariffs, with just the right labor positions, with just the right products or services, they'll get destroyed by the global market, and then that market will move in and say, you're doing this now, that's what you get. Like clean drinking water in Africa and Coca-Cola.
Yeah, I was about to mention too, in Africa, right, a lot of the jobs you get there are really, really dangerous. Like textiles down there is really, really dangerous. So you're literally sitting in cesspools of chemicals most of the time.
Yeah.
And I mean, really, that's one of the only, like, that's one of the few labor positions available to you. But it gets really weird too, because one interesting thing is that a lot of charities, for instance, will try to give, you know, clothing or food or something to, you know, poor African countries. Ironically, a lot of them have an adverse impact because it has an economic impact. If you suddenly throw a million shoes at some African country, every shoemaker in that country now no longer has a job.
Yeah. That and ironically, those shoes were probably made in Malaysia anyway, so.
Yeah, and this gets us into it's complicated, and you're right to point out that like these global markets are political forces in and of themselves.
Right.
And I think that I think the real problem is that we have to ask the question, do these international markets really come to the benefit of most people? And in some ways they do, right? They've reduced global poverty by record amounts, but in some ways they really don't,
because it sometimes upsets the sovereignty of countries and even individuals. And that can be really... look, if you go into a country and you bring in all of your market interests, you can utterly warp and destroy that culture.
Absolutely. And not only that, as part of that, you can destroy the identity of the people that live there. Mm-hmm. It's not any surprise that, people have a sort of love of country because they were born there. And I'm not saying that that's... I'm not judging anybody that feels that way. You know, if you're born in a place and you like that place because you've lived there your entire life, you just, it's part of who you are. If you'd go traveling or something like that, you say, oh yeah, I'm an American. You almost don't even think about it. Of course, you're just going to say that. And of course, whatever country you're in, they're probably going to try to start speaking English with you because, that's the in thing. Which is also interesting about cultures and economies, that even though more people in the world speak Chinese as a native language, more people are learning English because the United States has such a huge economic export in the entire world that is a marketable skill. Being able to speak English is a marketable skill. And so this loss of identity, or the meaning of said identity in a country or culture, is what's leading to this resurgence of economic nationalism. So,
I'd even argue actual nationalism.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to keep this on the not social side, but he's absolutely right.
Right. Yeah. And then these things tie intimately to political and social concerns. We've seen, for instance, a spike in crimes of white nationalism. And I do think that this is intimately tied to the economic concerns, because if you look at Trump's voter base, for instance, a lot of them is disgruntled middle-aged white men who've lost their jobs or now in this economic system that took them from a good position and totally decimated them. And I mean, I don't know what to do about that.
Yeah, well, and that's that's a big issue, because there is a certain good nature about the idea of economic nationalism, where you are fundamentally concerned with your country's economic well-being, first out the gate. And I don't have an issue with that, per se. There will come a point where the economic interests of your country are satisfied to reasonable means, where, there isn't mass poverty, mass homelessness, things like that, where people are generally well taken care of. Then you have to look outside of your country because, those who have the means should use those means for those who don't. And I just want to put a quick quote about globalism from J.R. Saul's article in Harper's Magazine from 2004. It's the March 2004 thing. It's page 33 to 43. The collapse of globalism and the rebirth of nationalism. This was kind of a hot one for me. I thought it was interesting. Saul writes, government after government, as if in a fit of moralism, legislated its right to take on debt or collect new taxes, even though both of these were fundamental governmental powers, central to the construction and maintenance of democracies. In fact, debt and taxes and played the same fundamental role in pre-democratic period. At the same time, the private sector invented myriad new debts and privatized taxes for itself. Everything from junk bonds to credit cards was treated as an unregulated privatized currency, and corporations used the old default mechanism more than ever to clear their own decks of whatever it was handy to do so. And I particularly like that, for a number of reasons. This is the social reforms that happened in the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, all of that happening. Legislation got passed. The social structures were starting to renormalize after all of this. And all of the new social institutions and leaders everybody was breathing. They were, as Saul writes, the government was trying to you know, continue to manage all of these things. And while the government was managing all of these things, the economy is like, mine. And they just took over. Mm-hmm. And now here we are.
A lot of it was a pro-business political regime. Yeah. I mean, Reagan is a perfect example of that.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, like our political leaders at that point were, let's unleash capital, you know, trickle down.
It'll trickle down.
Right. And it's interesting because this nationalist tendency, a lot of people associate this with the right. You know, they think whenever you hear the word nationalist, you usually think of right wingers. You know, the Third Reich, for instance, and white nationalism. But there's a flavor of nationalism even on the left, which is, you know, if you think of very protectionist socialism, you know, that can be a brand of nationalism.
Oh, absolutely. And it's funny that we went to economic nationalism under the first actor, mm-hmm. and now we're to the next actor, and we're reaching economic nationalism as a topic again. So basically, don't elect actors. They don't make great presidents. Thanks, bye.
Yeah. So, hence why, as I said many, many times, do not think of economics as here and politics as here. That is just wrong to think of that way. Now, Mark Blythe would indicate that politics and society acts as the hardware for which your economy is the software.
Right. Yeah. And just want to throw another Saul quote out there. Soon people began to notice other contradictions in global orthodoxy. How could the same ideology promise a planetary growth in democracy and yet a decline in the power of the nation state? Democracy exists only inside countries. Weaken the nation state and you weaken the democracy. And so this upwelling of globalized economy has actually kind of devalued individual governments.
Oh yeah, and we saw this in 2016. Think about it. Facebook has Facebook and Cambridge Analytica demonstrated to us just how powerful, like, individual companies can be and swaying politics. We've seen lobbyists for sure, but the ability to manipulate individuals is insane. Certainly, yeah, it was Russia, and yeah, it was like a fraudulent business, Cambridge Analytica. But imagine if Facebook itself wanted to affect the election.
How do we know that it hasn't already? Like,
I'm not trying to conspiracize here. I'm not saying that they did, right? And right. But the thing is, we would have no way of knowing. And then, and clearly, as these things get colossal, you know, and as we go increasingly, you know, we have to have checks on these things. And while it does seem unsavory to some, right, and while it can potentially have bad consequences, the alternative is giving this power over to another set of individuals who aren't democratically responsible.
Right. Like, a neural network on a website is not a democracy. It's, you know, for people who don't know a lot about AI, a neural network is kind of like, that's what, like, the YouTube algorithm is, you know, judges what's popular by what's getting watched and promotes what's getting watched more. So things that get more watch time get promoted. Well, Facebook is a little bit like that, except that things that you interact with more are more likely to show up in your feed. So if you are, you know, let's say that you like the page Occupy Democrats. I don't happen to, because it's kind of, anyway, it's not great content altogether. Most political pages aren't, but like, if I continue to engage with that and even saying, like, you know, angry reacting on things and just commenting on things and having conversations with people on these posts, their posts are going to show up more. Like, go on your friends, if you have Facebook, go like a couple of their posts your entire feed within 2 days probably is going to get filled up with their posts. Like, every single post that they make, if they're, you know, meme stormers like I used to be, that's all you see. It's like, oh, you engaged with that, so we're going to just shove it in your face. It's like, you engage with one thing, who knows what that's done for the kind of content you're going to see.
And now consider the fact that, like, some 60% of Americans get most of their news from Facebook.
Yeah, like, thank you, Coffee and Tia. I agree. yeah, which, I mean, getting your news from social media sounds bad enough. Let's be real. And, like, put that in the perspective of this algorithm that hand-selects your content for you. You can't in any way make it so that you see all of your friends' content and all of your page-like content. You can't do it anymore. That used to be the way it operated. When you clicked on, like, settings for your news feed thing, you could have top stories, which was things that people were interacting with a lot, and then you had most recent. And the most recent one gave you everything. Usually. But now even most recent shows you, oh, well, this person posted these things recently. You don't need to worry about this other person over here. They didn't post anything you like. This is what you like.
And just to make sure people are following, the reason why this ties into economics is because Facebook's doing this because it makes some money.
Yeah. Insane amounts of money.
So it's a perverse incentive, right? They're making money might harm our democracy. So how do we, you know, we have to deal with this somehow.
Yeah. So, and, you know, because everybody likes to rag on Zuck because it's really easy. Mark Zuckerberg, when he went to the congressional hearing about, like, data security and Facebook and stuff like that, his net worth went from some $60 billion to some $35 billion. And the most perverse thing about that is that his lifestyle will not change even though he lost $25 billion.
Yeah, because honestly, after the first billion, you don't really notice.
What? Probably. After how many million do you not notice? Really?
Actually, and this is another funny point. After about $100,000, the amount of money you have has a negligible impact on your well-being. So if we're going to, like, optimize for people's well-being, really, you don't have much of a purpose in having more than $100,000. Now, this isn't me saying we're going to cap income at $100,000. I don't care who you are, but my point is, like, these people have an inordinate amount of wealth, have no real, like, it's not benefiting society, it's not benefiting persons. And so unless they're, like, reinvesting that or using that in a means to help other people, it's really counterproductive.
Yeah, and ironically, not even helping other people, they can't even help themselves. Like, to put it in really just, like, I'm what matters perspective, like, it doesn't help. You've maxed out what you can do for yourself, except, you know, hitting even more lines of cocaine in the morning. I don't know how I could do that. That's a joke.
When do you think that? I mean, who are you targeting? Zuck or Musk?
Well, you know, I respect Elon Musk for smoking dope on Joe Rogan's podcast. Not for any other reason than, like, it's kind of cool, I guess. He looked pretty cool doing it, except the giant smoke clouds that he was puffing out were definitely not him inhaling any smoke. So, try again, Elon.
So, I think, how are you feeling about this conversation so far?
Well, the coffee maker's turned off, my cup's almost empty, and I think we've hit it pretty hard.
So, why don't we end off on where we personally lie on these things?
Well, why don't you start it off?
Okay.
You've been hot about this for, like, weeks, so yeah. I want to give you the opportunity.
So, me personally, I think that capitalism is really hard to get right. It's possible. It's certainly possible. But you have a lot of countervailing forces that need to be delicately balanced. And it will necessarily go through boom and bust cycles. Certainly, we don't want to do what we did in 08. That's just a bad idea. If it's going to fail, it has to fail so we can build something new, something that really resets the hardware of this stuff. By that, I mean the political and social circumstances in which the economy exists. Failing that, I think that I'm personally a fan of some measure of socialism. I want to say before people get triggered, markets and capitalism are separable. You can have you can have markets in a socialist economy. So what I mean by some measure of socialism is I think that we're increasingly coming into a world where there will be globalized forces. There's no one nation who can really rein in Facebook from being a global power. And while I do think that nations should try to take back more for their sovereignty, and while I do think that we should be more careful about not giving power to corporations, the best way to handle this would be to provide some democratic control on the markets itself. And I think that ultimately that will look like socialism. But that being said, I'm a fan of market socialism because I recognize that decentralized systems are very, very good for individuals when they're tuned right. For instance, TV, couch, right? And I would prefer not to have a system that would prevent that kind of transaction, even at scale.
Absolutely. I would agree with a lot of that. Though, me personally, I find myself a little bit more on the capitalist side of things. I think that if you are a company or a business owner and you want to make a product or provide a service and make money, I think that you should be allowed to do that. And with some regulation, and I say that as... I don't want an economy where people don't take risks to make more money, because when people make money, that's a good thing. And that, like, corporations, individuals in a workplace, when people make money, it's good, because it can benefit them and it can benefit other people. What I would like to see is an end to the wealth hoarding, you know. Let's have a system that encourages capital, that encourages growth, that encourages, you know, individuals taking responsibility for themselves and generating wealth for themselves. And let's also say, you don't have to have it all to yourself. It can do lots more for you if you invest it in the public, which is where the, you know, I think I'm a similar shade of capitalism with maybe a few less socialist streaks. That's where the good of humanity should also be weighed into this. And of course, that brings about a whole bunch of, moral claims about, you know, who deserves what based on what labor, like, labor theory of value and stuff like that. But yeah, at some point we can just say, you don't need this anymore. Fundamentally, the market should be the one that realizes this. Pragmatically, the governments have to tell the market that so that they do it. But of course, when we've created a global marketplace that is more powerful than basically every government in the world, it's hard. And I'm absolutely against that kind of global global economic power. That's horrible. That's horrifying. Like, that's the worst conception of global unity under one thing I can think of. That's just
we'll one day achieve world peace, and it's through markets. Let me tell you.
World peas. Everybody gets to eat peas. The market will dictate that peas are the best food, so we'll have world peas.
Yeah, we'll become really efficient at making them, let me tell you.
Man, those GMO peas, though.
So, we hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you have any arguments, feel free to leave them in the comments. I will preface neither, well, not post-base, no, it's not preface anymore. Neither of us are experts in economics, but we tried to do the best we could. There are more specific things that we do want to get into in the future, like universal basic income, maybe talking about, like, specifically about socialism, specifically about capitalism, but we feel like this is a good overview. If you have any other interest in the topics we presented in this episode or future episodes, please leave a comment.
Absolutely. And, you know, make sure you're keeping on the feed for the Fill the Gaps episodes, because I'm sure that if universal basic income doesn't get its own full-length episode, it will definitely get a Fill the Gaps episode. We had quite a spicy conversation yesterday about UBI, and where we agree on a fundamental level, but on a practical level, it's diametrically opposed. So it'll be a hot episode, whatever it turns into.
Well, I'm excited for that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we'll have plenty of coffee, so we'll be energized. We're brewing Death Wish coffee again in this episode, thanks to Coffee Intia. We're looking at maybe trying to get a sponsorship from them.
I hope. I mean, we're basically advertising for them already.
Yeah, so, yeah, we're getting advertisements, like banner ads, on the video for Death Wish coffee, because I mentioned it once in passing in the first episode. Justin's rocking one of their mugs, We Can Brew It, Rosie the Riveter mug that they came out with this year. I'm rocking my, my Valhalla Java, mug again. So, you know, what do you guys think about, getting a sponsorship from coffee? I mean, we do have philosophy degrees, so, like, the coffee keeps us away from the bottle.
Yeah. Well, I'd die, but.
Well, yeah. Yeah, you and your alcohol allergy. It's honestly probably for the best, to be completely honest.
Yeah.
Philosophy does funny things when you mix it with whiskey. That's like whiskey soured. But anyway, thanks for watching, everyone. Make sure you tune in next month for the big episode, and tune in the interim for the Fill the Gaps episode. Last thoughts?
Thanks, Coffee Antia.